All right, so we'll start at the top of Kuf Tet Zayin Mud Aleph, about 2, 4, 6 lines down. Tanya Kavati to Rav Yehuda. So if you remember, in yesterday's daf, there was machlokas between Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna with regards to how many malkut you get if a person is chovel, a rechayim, and a rochev. If you take the two parts of the kli, according to Rav Huna, if you do rechayim v'rochev, you get 3 sets of malkut. You get 1 for rechayim, 1 for rochev, and then 1 for right, ki nefesh hu chovel. According to Rav Yehuda, it's chovel and if you were chaval, a rechaim and rochav, you get 2 malkus. But nefesh hu chovel is not applicable to rechaim v'rochav, but to any other item besides rechaim v'rochav. So you only get 2 sets of malkus, not 3 sets of malkus. Now the Gemara says, Tanya Kavati to Rav Yehuda. We have a braisa that supports the position of Rav Yehuda. Now according to Rashi, the Gemara is going to bring down actually 2 braitot, not a single braisa, but actually 2 braitot. And Rashi says that the proof is actually from the combination of the 2 braitot. And therefore, in upcoming in the Gemara, the Rashi is Gores, and that's what our Gemaras have. Usually we do have Rashi's amended girsa, which is Vitanya Idach, that we have an additional braisa, so the 2 braitot together, we'll see in a second, make up the proof for Rav Yehuda. On the other hand, the Re doesn't like that Pshan Rashi, believes that there is a proof from each braisa independently, and therefore he has the girsa of Tanya Idach without the Vav in it. We'll read it like Rashi, and we'll explain it like Rashi, and then we can just take a look at the Tosfos, see what Tosfos' issues are. So Tanya Kavati Rav Yehuda, Chaval Zug Shel Tzeparim, he took a pair of scissors, Be'etzemed Shel Parot. Now Zug Shel Tzeparim, in their day, it's clear in many places in the Gemara, were really a scissors made up of 2 blades. And the way they looked at it, they were actually 2 independent kelim, 2 separate blades. So Zug Shel Saparim is because it's called a zug because it's a pair of blades that make up a scissors. Vitzemed shel parot. Now Rashi learns that zemed shel parot is actually 2 cows, 2 plowing cows with their zemed, right, with the actual yoke or the piece that keeps them together to work together in a unified manner. That's the you took both of those. You took that whole unit together. And they are classified as ochel nefesh in this instance because they work and create the ochel nefesh. They are the livelihood of possibly of this individual. So in this case, the braisa says chayev shtayim. In this case, you're chayev 2. If 2 malkus, if you take the zug shel saparim or you take the tzemach shel parot, you're chayev 2. If you took 1 blade of the scissor, or you took 1 of the parot, meaning that, and Rashi points out that the tzemed must be made out of component parts that can be put together between the 2 animals, meaning locked together somehow. So in that instance, if you only took 1 of them, you're only chayev achat. So this braisa, which seems to be a proof to Rabbi, on the surface seems to be a proof to Rabbi Yehuda, and that's what the Re says, because Rabbi Yehuda says, you're only chayev 2 malkus. When you have 2 items, you're chayev 2 malkus. And not a 3rd malchus for ki right nefesh hu chovel, that you're not chayiv for at all. Then Rashi says, but that's not the case here. The case here, why this is not a proof, is because Rav Yehuda only speaks about a case of. It's only really speaking of Haz and Rav Yehuda are speaking about a case of rechaim and rochav that are explicit in the pasuk. Right here, we're talking about a zug shel saparim and tzemet shel parot. The reason you're chayav, both according to Rav Yehuda and according to Rav Yehuda, is ki nefesh hu chovel. Right. So there's only 1 Iser. For each Kli, there's 1 Iser. So from this Brace, we have no proof to Rabbi Yehuda. That's what Rashi says. Only with combination of the next Brace do we have a proof. So then, Vitanyo Yidoch, we have an additional Brace that says, Chaval Zug Shel Saparim, Vitzemet Shel Parot. Again, the same items that he took as Klaro. Yocholo Yechayv Alachat. You would think he's only Chayv once in this instance. Tamar Lomar Yochbo Rechayim Varochev. Ma Rechayim Varochev Shehin Miyuchadim Shnei Kelim Vosim Lachachat. They are 2 separate items, but they do, or they have 1 utility, or 1 purpose. Meaning that a Rechayim and Rochev together produce the milling, right? Each one independently can't do it, but each one is a Kli by itself. Azeh Bifnei Atzmo, Vizeh Bifnei Atzmo. And right, if he takes, or is chayev on each one by itself, av kol devarim, any other item, she'ein shnei kelim yuchadim vosim lechachat, they're 2 independent units that do a single utility, chayev al zeh b'fnei atzmo v'zeh b'fnei atzmo, is chayev on each one independently. So that's this braisa, which the first braisa doesn't do, draws a parallel to between other kelim and rechaim verochev. What this brisa says is that the positions of Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna are not unique to rechaim verochev. That this brisa sees rechaim verochev as a paradigm for other kelim, and that just like by rechaim verochev, you're chayiv on each kli independently, so too by a pair of scissors or tzemet b'shel parot. Now, once we know that information, that the brisa views a pair of scissors and a pair of cows or oxen in the same way they review Rechaim V'Rochav. Now, if we go back to the first brisa, right, the first brisa teaches us what? That you're only chayiv twice. Now, if we look at a scissors or a pair of cows as being the same as Rechaim V'Rochav, according to Rav Huna, the first brisa should have said you were chayiv shalosh, you're chayiv three. And the fact that it doesn't is a proof to Rav Yehuda. Now, it explains that the reason you can't bring a proof from the second brisa is because the brisa there may not say that you don't get three malchus. All the second brisa says is that pair of scissors and pair of cows is equal to rechaim verochav. What it does not address is ki nefesh hu chovel. Maybe that brisa would also think you get three malchus. That's not what all the brisa is addressing, is that if you have two kelim that make up a single utility or a single purpose, they get malchus on each kli separately. That's all that brisa is teaching you. It's not teaching about how many malchus you get in this instance. So that's why, according to Rashi, you need the first brisa and you need the second brisa. The second brisa teaches you the parallel between rechaim verochav and other kelim, and the first brisa teaches you two and not three. So between the two of them, we have a proof to the position of Rav Yehuda. Oh, hey, Tosa says, who says that the two brayot have anything to do with each other? And Tosa says that each one can stand independent. Tosa says, Rashi's whole opinion is premised in the first place is why? Because if you just had the first brayot, you would say, oh, the reason you're chayiv in each of these kelim is because of nefesh hu chovel. But had you had, right, but who knows what they say about the three malchus or two malchus? It's not parallel to the case that Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna argue about. So it says, no, the Rish says, what are you talking about? If the Isur is because Nefesh Hu Chovel, then Nefesh Hu Chovel would only provide one lav, one Isur. I mean, no matter how many Kelim, right, then it would only be one Isur. So that first Breitza, if you say the reason for the lav is Nefesh Hu Chovel, Nefesh Hu Chovel then for a pair of scissors or for a pair of parot would only give you one malchus. So therefore, by the definition, if the Breitza says there are two malchus here, it must believe that first Breitza must believe also this parallel of Rechaim Verochev. If it believes in that parallel of Rechaim Verochev, then it's clear from that first Breitza that the lav that you're being getting malchus for is Rechaim and Rochev. And then according to Yehuna, it should have said the third one. So Tosa says no, that they can stand independently and that the first brisa is sufficient. Now that answers your question, Shoal, which is, okay, how do you know that the brisa would have anything to do with each other? According to the read, it's exactly that, because the first brisa shows you by fact that it has two malchus that it's holding of this position of the second brisa, which is rechaim verochav. Otherwise, it should only be one malchus, because there's only one iser, then of nefesh hu chovel. Nefesh hu chovel, no matter how many kelim you have, should be only one iser, one lav. Right, so the difference between Rashi and Tosas' understanding is that Tosas believes the first brisa is self-sufficient, and Rashi needs the second brisa, and the difference or their premise is about how many malchus you would get for nefesh hu chovel. This has to do, if you have the iser of nefesh hu chovel, and now you have a pair of scissors or a pair of parot, according to Rashi, you would actually get two sets of malchus. You get one for each blade of the scissor. You would get one for each of the parot. Whereas according to Tosvot, if you have ki nefesh hu chovel's the isur, no matter how many kelim you have here as part of it, you'd only get one malchus. So that's the key difference between Rashi and Tosos. Tosos, you're right, in the end, needs the position of the second brisa, but he says it's built into the first brisa. You could learn it out from that first brisa, because the only reason you could get two sets of malchus is because of Rechaim and Rochav. You couldn't get it because of nefesh hu chovel. As a side, the Rashi explains, we said all the way along here, they're talking about two cows in a yoke or some sort of kli that maintains keeps them together. The reed disagrees. He says that tzemed parot means literally means the yoke and not the parot, not the cows themselves. I mean, it just means the yoke and not the cows, and you could split it two pieces. It could be made into two pieces. So it's the Rashi who thinks it's the tzemed plus the parot. Okay, now we have a case in the Gemara. So there was a how gavra the chovel sakina dashkavta mechavre, a person who took as a mashkon a knife, deshkavta, knife of deshkavta, shall beit mitbachayim, is the one of the shecht house, right, from the butcher's store. But it's not the knife that's used for shechting the animals, but rather it's the hatchet that's used to cut up the meat, right, that which is used to divide up or cut up the meat. So he took this knife, which is clearly a ochel nefesh, Atta the kame de baye, so he came before baye. Amalei zil hadre. First of all, give it back to him. Da havalei klisho simbo nechol kol nefesh. It's a klisho simbo kol nefesh, and therefore you lose it. Va ta kum bedina ala. And number two, you got to prove that he owes you the money. Where's your evidence that there is a loan outstanding over here? Do you have edim? You know, if you want to collect from this individual, you got to bring a rayo that he owes you money. Rav Amar, Rav says no. Lo tzarich lemekim bedina ala. He doesn't have to go to din on this item at all. Yocholiton ad kedei demehem. And he's allowed to extract from this kli the amount of money that he's owed over here because of the claim that he can make, which is that lakuachu biyadi, that I purchased it. And since he could say, I purchased it, and now he's saying, listen, I took it as a mashkon, we say it's a migo. The migo, if he had said lakuachu biyadi, he'd keep the whole thing, then the fact that he admits here that it's a mashkon, we say then he should be neman to take out of it the amount of his loan, or the value of his loan. So therefore, he doesn't have to bring proof or raya for his loan. Actually, the raya or the burden of proof is going to be on the other individual to show that there wasn't a loan here. Otherwise, he can keep ad kedei demehem. Right, right. We're going to see in a second that the Gemara, it really narrows their machlokas down. And Abaye agrees to this principle of Rava. So, and the answer I could say to you is yes, but I think from the Gemara further on, it sounds like Abaye just agrees to Rava. It's just they're arguing about on nuances of when that you can make such a conclusion or not make such a conclusion. So Abaye lately house varu. Abaye really doesn't hold of this position of Rava or this idea that Rava says that you have a migo over here. So maishna mahanu ize the achle chushla benardo. What's the difference between these izim, these goats that came and were eating up the grain, or it was seems to be barley, peeled barley or shelled barley in Narda. Vata Mara de Chushla, and the individual whose property was being damaged, but Tavas Lahu, he grabbed them, Bekartain Tuva, and he made a good claim, meaning that he took them and he made them pay, he used them to pay for his loss. Vamar Vua de Shmuel, Yocholiton ad Kade de Mehem. The father of Shmuel says you can go ahead and take up to the value of the money. So it says, "Hatam lavmide de avda the ushule of the loan." No, what he lost. Ad kedei demehem up to the amount. I mean, up to the. Obviously, he could take up to the value of the goats. I mean, up to the value of the goats, or the up to the value of his loss. I mean that he whatever's the right the lower of the two, he'll get. He'll get either the value of the goats, or he'll get the value of his property. I mean, so now, Gemara says, over there, why is he believed to keep them and to say whatever the loss is or to claim, whatever his claim is, why is he believed to take out his claim over here? Nobody lends out or rents out goats. Those are the types of items that you lend out. So if it's in his possession, then it's obviously lakuachu biyadi. Then it's clearly purchased. So therefore, when he makes the claim that it's purchased, when he makes it, or he comes along and says, listen, I took them as collateral, I took them to pay for the damage they did, then he's neman in that instance because the only alternative is lakuachu biyadi. Avahocha midid avid loshule lugurehu. When it comes to the knife here, there's a possibility that he lent it to him. So for him to come along and say, lakuachu biyadi, that's not a definitive claim because there's another possibility, which is that he actually borrowed the knife. And if he borrowed the knife, he could have been in his possession, but that doesn't prove that it's his. I mean, that doesn't prove that it's his. Him. So he can't make a migo claim that, oh, I could have said I bought it. That's just not true. The shalach, Rav Huna bar Avin, dvarim asuim lashilu haskir, items that are normally lent out or rented out, v'amar lekuchim hen biyadi, and then he says, I purchased them, einu ne'amon, he's not believed, meaning that the migo doesn't stand, because now there aren't only two alternatives, right? The two alternatives before were mashkon and I bought it. Now there's a third and fourth alternative, which is that he borrowed it and he rented it. And the other two alternatives are not alternatives that give him real ownership over the item. So Gemara says, "V'Rava lately ha'isvara." What about Rava? Rava doesn't hold of this position if it's rentable or lendable that you can't make this migo of lakuachu biyadi. V'ha Rava afik zuga desarvela v'safra degarata miyatme. So, b'dvarim shasum lashil askir. Didn't Rava remove a zuga desarvela over here, which is a scissors? Of the, I don't call them the shearing scissors or scissors, wool cutting scissors. And Safra Dagata is obviously a safer of Agada in it from Yutomim. And this was in a case, but very much similar to Shileskir. So what's the case over here? That the Balim, the owners, brought witnesses that they belong to them. And he says that they lent them to the father of these orphans, and they want them back. And Rova went ahead and took them away from the orphans and handed them back to them. Now, if there's really a claim that the orphans could have said, the Yatomim could have said, the Kuach Hubiyadi, or the Kuchim Heim Biyadeno, that we actually purchased these items, then Beis Din would be Toein on their behalf to say, the Kuchim Heim Biyadeno. The fact that Beis Din isn't Toein on their behalf to say that shows you that you can't make such a claim in the face or in the case where the item is normally lent out or rented out. So, Amar Lecha Rava, Hainami, Kevan, Demei, Pangma, Kapte in Shevelo Moshle. Rava is going to say by the knife, it's the same thing. A knife is blunted or gets ruined by its usage, and therefore people are makbid, not to lend out. It's a delicate item or a specific professional item that people wouldn't otherwise lend out. And since they wouldn't lend it out, he can make such a claim as Lekuach Hubiyadi. So now if you come down, your question before is, what does Abaye hold? It sounds like Abaye and Rava hold the same thing, which is that there is such a concept called, you could say, Lekuach Hubiyadi, and then you would be believed with regards to the Mashkon up to the value of the loan that is being claimed over here. And then you have to return the rest. And the burden of proof is going to then lay with the supposed lover, supposed borrower over here. And Abaye agrees to that, and Rav agrees to that. And they also agree that if it's a kli, it's a utensil that normally is lent out or rented out, then there is no such claim that the person can make. He can't say Lekuach Hubiyadi, because there's a counterclaim can say that I lent it to you or I rented it to you, and therefore his migo falls away. So now, what is the machos between Abaye and Rava? The machos between Abaye and Rava is simply about which utensils are classified as being lent out or not being lent out. By knife, they argue about whether a knife, people do normally lend it out. That's Abaye's position. And according to Rava, the knife that don't lend out. Abaye believes that this knife would normally be lent out. Therefore, there's no migo. And Rava says it's not an item that people would otherwise have lent out. And because of that, right, there is a migo over here, and that's why he is Ne'eman. There's an interesting re over here that says that when it comes to the restriction against taking items that are ochel nefesh, the re says that this only applies to kelim shosim behem ochel nefesh. That's the issue. So near the re, dafka kelim aval ochlim atzman mutar lechbo. But it comes to food itself, you could take. So according to the re, it comes out interestingly enough that the issue is not about his eating today, right, or having food. It's about his ability to sustain himself or his parnasa. And therefore, kelim shel ochel nefesh, you can't take away because that prevents him from sustaining himself in the future. Whereas ochlim themselves, you could take because that has nothing to do with his future ability to support himself. That's about, right, his current food situation, but not about his ability to continue to live. So therefore, restriction only applies to ochel nefesh, kelim shel ochel nefesh. Right. I wonder, and I think you're right, your question is valid, that if the food, right, has ability to sustain him, or that will provide his parnasa, does that then become a ochel nefesh versus, right, a kli ochel nefesh versus ochel nefesh itself? It's a good question. It could be that the Re believes that that's, a biased statement, zil hadre le davi le kli shosim bo ochel nefesh, then maybe the Isser applies to both, but you only have to return a kli shosim bo ochel nefesh. That's another possibility of how to read the Re, that the obligation to return it is only on those instances, but although the Isser might apply to both, taking both. All right, so new perek. This is the last perek of Baba Metzia. Gets a little warm up for Baba Basra, as always here, so we can get into. So Abayit Valiyah Shel Shnayim. You have a house, and I mean, a two-level house, right? It's a duplex. The bottom part belongs to one individual, the top part belongs to another individual. Shenaflu, they fell down. The house collapsed. Shnehem Chokim Beitzimu Vavanimu Afar. They divide up. They divvy up the wood, the rocks, the stones, or the bricks, and the dirt or the cement. They divide up whatever is there that's left over from the house. They divide it up. I mean, divided doesn't necessarily have to mean 50-50, but it's basically on the size of their house. You know, I mean, if the lower house was much bigger than the upper house, then on a pro rata basis, they would take out of the ruins that are left over here. Now, Viroim, we do assess, Elu Avanimo Siyut Ishtaber, which bricks should have broken, And therefore, we distribute them based on that. We'll see in a second what that means in the Gemara. Im haya echad mehen makir miktzat avanav, if one of them recognizes some of the stones from his house, notlan, he can actually take those stones if he can clearly identify them. V'lo lo min hacheshbon, and it counts towards his division that we establish over here. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to dissect all these lines in the Mishnah, all these different statements in the Mishnah. Miktani ro'in. So the Mishnah says that we assess or we look at what makes sense. I mean, that we bring in the forensic experts to look at how the house fell down here. Michlau, demika the makeum alayu ibachas achavsa nafil, ibachavta nafil. We take a look at this and we assess whether the house collapsed downward or fell over. Meaning that which part of the house, if it collapsed downward, meaning that the whole house imploded, then the indication is that the lower part of the house collapsed first, right? And that's probably where the broken bricks are, and the upper part fell in on top of it. So therefore, the upper level bricks belong to the Aliyah, the lower level bricks belong to the, right, the Bayit, and likely broken bricks probably belong to the Bayit. On the other hand, if it toppled over, then the likelihood is obviously the bricks that are closer belong to the Bayit, the bricks that are further away belong to the Aliyah, but the bricks that broke are most likely belonging to the Aliyah because they fell further away. They have much longer fall. So that's the difference. Chavsa is to implode, and then chavta is to be knocked over to, right, fall over, topple over. So here, the Gemara says, so based on... Right, I mean, the implosion has to be that way, right? I mean, I don't... Obviously, that causes... The collapse is caused by the fact that the lower house broke, and the bricks broke there. I mean, that's obvious from the storm force that hit the lower part of the house, and then it caused it to implode, you would have the same result. So, I don't know. I'm a little more cautious about saying that the cause was external versus internal, rather than that it's an implosion versus a toppling of the brick. You know, meaning that, for instance, the World Trade Center's collapse imploded, even though it was an external force that caused them to implode. All right, so now the Gemara says, okay, if we're bringing in forensic experts and the Mishnah, right, condones such a division, then why do we have in the beginning of the Mishnah, Habayit v'Aliyah shel shnayim shafnu shneihem chokim? Why is there ever a chokim? Chokim should be in the context of all the forensic evidence that's here. So the Gemara says, Yehochi reisha mai chokim. Nechse, let us look. Ibechavta nafil. Was it toppled over? Then aliyata itbor. And it's probably that the upper part of the house that broke, right, that was smashed. Ibechavta nafil. Or was it that it imploded? And then tatya itbor. And then it's the bricks, the lower bricks, or the supporting bricks that cracked or broke. Either from the, again, like you were saying, so either because of the fact that they imploded, and that's what caused the... they broke, and that's what caused the bayit to fall, or because of the pressure. I mean, that because they're now at the bottom, and the implosion causes everything to fall on top of it, then they're more likely to have the broken bricks. Where it says, Lo tzricha d'nafu b'leilu, fell at night, so they couldn't see how it fell. They don't know why it fell. So where it says, well, that's the whole idea of forensic evidence. Lichzei b'tzafra. Just look when the sun rises the next morning, you can see where the brick, where the whole thing's laying out. So where it says, the paninu, they removed it. Someone says, "V'lechzei man paninu v'lishalei." Let's find out who carried away the bricks, and we'll ask them how did it look. Someone says, "The paninu b'nei b'yushet tervayim v'azul alma." It was I don't know if these are good Samaritans or it was blocking the reshut rabbim, and therefore they came and cleared it out. I mean that there's no particular individual who's responsible for clearing it out, but it was cleared out, and therefore we don't have any way to know or assess the situation or the forensic evidence. Gemara says, "V'lechzei b'reshut man yatvan." So Gemara says, "Well, let's see where into whose possession the items fell." And then Elhavi Idach Amotzi Michaver Lavaraya. Because we say that the chazaka is whoever's in possession of the item, they're muchzak in the item. If they're muchzak in the item, the other person has to be Amotzi Michaver Lavaraya. So it's important here to note that when you look at Amotzi Michaver Lavaraya, you can look at it in one of two ways, right? But we read it and we always think about it as the simple way to read it is that Amotzi Michaver Lavaraya is that the fact that a person is muchzak in the item is an evidentiary claim. I mean, it shows that it probably is theirs. Because why else are they holding on to it? Why else is it in their possession unless it really is theirs? So therefore, we're using it as a biror. It's one of the pieces of evidence over here. I'm very aware of the fact that you're holding it. The other possibility of looking at Amotzi Mechaveru L'Raya is not that it's an evidentiary claim, but rather it's a issue of process. We need, from a judicial process standpoint, we have two parties that are making a claim. And we don't know, we have to put the burden of proof on one of the two parties. So we need some way to make it, we can't have it be that they both have the burden of proof, then we won't, you know, and leave it at Jivo Eliyahu. So we use Hamotzi Mechaveru L'Raya as a way to figure out in the process who the burden of proof is on. This Gemara, right, seems to be that. This Gemara, as opposed to other Gemaras, where it seems to be that Hamotzi Mechaveru L'Raya is an evidentiary claim, and therefore it's a birur, over here it's clear this can't be a birur. Because whoever's property the item is sitting in has nothing to do with the chazaka here. We know that the house collapsed, and we know that two people owned each portion of the house. So to say whoever's property the item is laying in has any evidentiary, right, makes any difference in the evidentiary claims here seems to be, right, meaningless of which the possession is. Ella, you must say, this has to do with process. Whoever's, meaning that rather it's a chra, rather than a birur. Now, chra is that when it's found in someone's possession, the other person has to bring a proof. And that's what it sounds like from this Gemara. That rather than being an evidentiary claim, that it's simply a process, a based in, it's a chra, rather than a birur. All right, so now Gemara says, Lotzricha, that it's not a case where one of them is mukhsakin. Why? Diyatvin b'chotzer devayu. Or either that it's a jointly owned chatzer, so there's no single ownership here. Inami b'shut rabim, the house fell into the reshut rabim, or the bricks fell into the reshut rabim. So again, no individual out of the two is more muchzak here than the other ones. Even though the chatzer is really owned by the bayit or by one of the individuals, in this type of living arrangement, the other individual is not makpid on the usage by the Aliyah or the other party. And since he's not makpid on that, it's as if they both own or have a possession of the chatzer, and therefore that's not enough to be create a chazak over here of ownership, since both parties really used or had the usage of the chatzer, even though technically it only belonged to one of the two individuals. Right now, the Gemara says, or the Mishnah said, Imaya chad mehen makir. If one of them decides that he recognizes his bricks and he can show that these are my bricks, then he gets to keep those. And then we net that against the other party has to take against this. Bhala matoin. The question is, what does the other party say? He says, these are my bricks. So what does the other party say? No, they're not. Yes, they are. I don't know. What does he say? So that's what Gemara wants to say. Bhala matoin. Ikamar in. If he says, yeah, they are your bricks, then pshita, of course he can keep the bricks. What's there to talk about? If he disagrees, then why is he allowed to take them? Meaning that it's bari v'bari. And then we have no muhzak here, as we saw from the Gemara above. So therefore, there's no reason that he should walk away with them. Ella, damarle ene yodea. He says, I don't know. So that means you have a bari and a shema here. That's the case in the Mishnah, bari v'shema. So lema taviyutufti the Rav Nachman. So should be a problem for Rav Nachman. The itmar, right? Because Rav Nachman manali biyadecha v'alo mer niyodeh. He says you owe me 100, and the other individual says I don't know. Rav Huna, Rav Yehuda, amrei chayav. That's a bari v'shema, and then you are a chayav. Rav Nachman, Rav Yochanan, amrei patur. That you're over here, you're in this case, when it's a bari and a shema, you're patur. So our Mishnah will present the problem for Rav Nachman, because our Mishnah says bari v'shema chayav. So k'dama Rav Nachman, go and chase Esek. I think the Gemara does it. I think when we discussed it earlier, it's first of all because the Gemara generally paskins like Rav Nachman, because halachik Rav Nachman bedine. Halach is like Rav Nachman and Dine, and therefore he's considered a koveya. So I think the Gemara is really after if they want to come to a psak halacha, they're really after what Rav Nachman says over here rather than what Rabbi Yochanan says over here. So Gemara says, like we said, similar to what we said before earlier in the Masechta, Kigon, Sheish, Esek, right? Kadam Rav Nachman, Kigon, Sheish, Esek, Shua, B'nayim. That there's a Shavu'ah that's causing the problem over here. I mean, there's an external factor which is generating the Bari and Shema are affected by this external factor. What does that mean? There's a Esek Shua. The case here is where he says, yes, you owe me 100, but Halo Omer, in. He says, listen, 50 I do owe you. Vashar any of that, but the remainder I don't know. So that's a case of modem miksat. Modem miksat demands a shvua mina Torah, and a shvua mina Torah to make yourself patur over here. Now, the shvua modem miksat is that I say, if I say I owe you 50 and you say you really owe me 100, then you have to take a shvua that I owe you no more than 50. In this case, he can't say that. Why? Because about the second 50, he doesn't know. So he can't take a shvua that he doesn't owe him the other 50. That he just can't do. So now what's the case? So truthfully, he would be patur b'modei miksat as long as he could take a shvua. But because of his claim in this case, he's prevented himself from ever being able to take the shvua. Since he can't take the shvua, he's going to be chayav. So that's what Rav Nachman says. The case here of Bari and Shema is not a simple case of Bari and Shema, and that's why you're chayav. Bari and Shema in general is patur. But the case here is a Bari and Shema in the context of a Shvua Modim Miksat, and the Bari, or really it's the Shema part of it, makes it impossible for him to take the Shvua Modim Miksat, and because of that, he is Chayav over here. Here, it's a Tosus on Tzadik Chedem and Aleph, Mitoch Sheni Ocholi Shava Mishalem. So you look at the end of that Tosus on there. It says, "Aval hocho v'naska she'eno yachol yishava lo machmat shu chashud." Not because he's suspected, meaning that the reason he can't take a shvua is because chashud al shvua. Then el ata b'tvia zu eno yachol yishava, but because of the actual claim and the way he's formulated his position, eno yachol yishava machmat ma'ura, because of the circumstances lo hitzrichu yishava shkenegdo. Chamin, we're not mitakin in that case that you flip the shvua to. So because the case of chashud al shvua is a general problem he's going to have in any shvua, in any case. And so then people can bring claim and claim after him, and he'll never be able to take a shvua, and he'll have to pay him every time. So we flip the shvua. Here it's case particular, the issue why he can't take a shvua. And so the chachamim were not mitakin in that case to flip the shvua, the kenegdo. All right, so now the Gemara talks about valot lo min hacheshbon. The Mishnah says that when he takes whole bricks and he says, those are my whole bricks, then the other individual nets out and takes a portion of the 50% against that. When he takes against that, what does he take against it? I mean, say that we have a mix of bricks, of whole bricks and broken bricks. This individual goes and takes that. He says, I recognize my bricks over there, and he takes out 10 whole bricks. What does the other individual get against that? Does he get 10 broken bricks against that, or does he get 10 whole bricks against that? So that happens to be a machlokas. So Gemara says, Sover Rav LeMeimar, L'chiv Cheshbon Shvurot. He gets, based on the broken bricks, that he'll get 10 broken bricks, Kenega, these 10 whole bricks that this individual takes. Now, Tosa says that it can't be, or the Reed says that it can't be, that he literally gets 10 broken bricks, because why should he have to take 10 broken bricks? But rather, he gets, based on the mix, there's a mix that, say, it's called 50-50. It's 50% whole bricks and 50% broken bricks. That means that each person is going to get 50% whole bricks and 50% broken bricks. If this individual takes and he recognizes 10 whole bricks, then the other individual against them will get 5 whole and 5 broken. Meaning, based on the pro rata, the way that it will divide normally, you'll get that percentage on the other side. So you'll get 10 bricks on the other side, but not 10 whole bricks. You'll get 5 whole and 5 broken, like the whole mixture is. That's the way the relearns it over here. Alma. Why? Because he says any odea. When he says any odea, he made his made the situation worse. He has a worse claim. So since he has the lower hand over here because he said any odea, therefore he has the lower hand entirely, meaning that he gets the mixture or the broken bricks, right, and not whole bricks. The other individual is worse. Why? If he only knows that these couple bricks are his, that means that the other bricks aren't his because he can't identify them. Right? Too late, right? So, so he shouldn't get any more. Bi'idach, kulu, deheach, ninu. And then the other bricks all belong to the other individual. So his claim is worse. Ela amar abai lefi cheshbon shleimot, that he gets whole bricks. I mean, if you take 10 bricks that you identify, then the individual gets 10 bricks that are unidentified against that 10 whole bricks, so that you end up netting out to the same thing. Gemara says, yochim hai kamani le. Then what does his identification do? I mean, that in the end, he's going to get 10 whole bricks. The other guy's going to get 10 whole bricks. It did nothing to identify his own bricks. I mean, everybody gets the same amount in the end anyway. Where it says, Lovano, Ravcho, mean that there are different types of bricks. Mean that there are some bricks that are wider versus the narrower bricks. And therefore, he, the ones that he recognized, those whole bricks that he recognizes are the ones that are wider. Or, Inami Tina Demavdo. It has to do, these are better quality bricks. I mean, there are also different qualities in the whole bricks. And therefore, since these are better quality bricks, and he can identify them, he gets to keep the 10 better quality bricks against 10 lower quality bricks that the end of the individual to take. So even though, truthfully, in the end, he gets the same Shleimot, meaning that they're netting Shleimot against Shleimot, but if he's able to identify his bricks, then if it's to his benefit, meaning that they're better quality or they're better, they're sized better, or they're wider, they're foundation stones, then in that instance, he gets to keep those against regular or normal whole bricks because he's able to identify them. That's his benefit of identifying. And by saying Durovo, don't say because the other guy says any Odea that he's worse, because the claimant, the person who's saying I identified 10 bricks, is also saying any Odea about the other bricks that he didn't take. I mean, he has that same negative side too. Just because he identified some bricks, but that means that he's saying any Odea about all the other bricks. So if you're going to say any Odea is Gari Tvei, then you can say it about it, the one who took the 10 bricks just as much as you can say it as with the one who doesn't. No. So Abai is just trying to say that you have an equal claim here. It's not that, right? It's not that it should be to the detriment of the one who can't identify. I don't think he's saying that it should be to the benefit necessarily of the one who can't identify. It's just that it shouldn't be to his detriment. Right. I would think so. When the Gemara, obviously, Rashi pointed this out earlier, when the Gemara starts out with the word Savar, usually means that the Gemara knows that it's going to get rejected. Savar means is a Havamina, and it's clear that the Maskona is Abaye, so that means that Rav in the end might have accepted Abaye's opinion. It's not clear that Rav is really arguing Abaye, but rather he just presented a position, and Abaye rejected that position, and Rav could have agreed to that rejection. Okay, next Mishnah, Abaye Dvaliyah. So over here, Rashi eliminates the girsa of Shoshnayim, because over here it's actually owned by one individual and it's being rented out. The upper half of the duplex is being rented out to someone, although the Tosfos wants to maintain the girsa and say even though it's Shnayim, Shnayim here is a Socher Maskir. All right, so now, Abaye Dvaliyah, Nifchata Haliyah. The upper part of the house, the duplex, upper part of the duplex, the floor caved in. Vein Bal Abayit Wotzele Takein. And the owner of the lower house, who is the maskir here, does not want to fix this, his roof, which is the floor for the upper half of the house. Then, Hare Bal Aliyah Yoreid V'dar Lamata, Ajitakein Lo Et Aliyah. Then the person living up the Aliyah can move in downstairs with the neighbors down, you know, with his landlord. And they can live together downstairs. So now, Rabbi Yossi Omer Atachton Notenet Atikrav Elyonet Atamaziva, that the landlord is responsible, we'll see when the Gemara was made, responsible for the roof or the boards, and the Elyon, the person who lives in the attic, is responsible for the maziva, for the plaster or the cement that is poured on top. So Gemara says, Nifchata Bekamo, how much of the floor has to collapse in here before, or the roof, I mean, it's the roof for the lower half, for the lower part of the duplex, or the floor of the upper half of the duplex, how much has to collapse in order to make this, the other individual able to go and live downstairs? Rava Mar Baruba, that has to be rove of the floor. Shmuel Amar Ba'arba'ah, four tfachim is enough. So Rava Mar Baruba says it has to be the majority of the floor. Aval Arba Lo. When it comes to four tefachim, no, Adam dar b'chetzio lamata v'chetzio lamala. People live on multiple floors. People are willing to have some of their possessions upstairs and some of their possessions downstairs. So Rav's suggestion is wherever there's a hole, wherever there's a missing part of the floorboards, you can put your items on the lower part of the house downstairs, and the rest of your stuff you'll keep upstairs. And if you need that stuff, you'll go downstairs and get it. People will live on two levels. Ushmo amar. Nobody lives with their possessions dispersed between two floors. They're not going to live on multiple floors over here. So that's one machlokes. Now the Gemara says, hey, tell me about the Mishnah. This is independently. Well, how do we explain our Mishnah? Then if the person said, I'm going to rent you out this aliyah, asda, it's your bad luck. We said this aliyah doesn't exist anymore, so you're out of luck. Ela damarle aliyah stam. if he says, you know, I'm gonna rent you out a upper half of a duplex, Loga Leachrite, why does he have to move in downstairs with him? Let him rent him out. Let the landlord rent out for him another location. So Amarava Lotzricha Damale Aliyah Zu, Shani Maskilicha, that this Aliyah, when I rent it out to you, Kisauka Salik Vado. Right? When you go, if it's there, as long as the Aliyah exists, you can live in it. Bechinachit, right? Chavat bededa. And if it collapses, you go with it. It says, Yehochi, my memra. What's the chiddush of the Mishnah? Of course. Right? Meaning that, or, I'm sorry, that you can, chavat bada, you can come down with it. Not that you will leave with it, but rather you can move downstairs with me. So then what's the big deal of the Mishnah? The Mishnah say exactly that. All right. So, that was the explicit tnai or condition of their rental. As long as there's an aliyah, you live upstairs. No aliyah, you come and move in with me downstairs. What do I need a Mishnah to tell me that you have to keep the tnai? This upper half of a duplex, which is on top of this house, that's what I'm renting to you. Because he then basically encumbered the lower half of the house to the aliyah. Why? Because he said something unnecessary. If he says aliyah zu, that I'm renting to you, that would have been sufficient. When he adds in the additional lashon shal gabei bayit zeh, which anybody could see, that it's above this house. As soon as he adds the words above this house, that means that that's extraneous language. It wasn't necessary. So we have to learn something from that extraneous language. Why did he say it? He must have said it because he's being mishubad, the lower house, meaning he's being encumbering the lower house to the fact that if the aliyah gets ruined or something happens to it, that the other individual can move in with him. V'chihad amar ravin bar Rav Adam or Rav Yitzchak, a similar case. Ma'ase be'echad shamar lechavero dayat shagabei farseik ze ani morcher lecha. That I am selling you this vine, this grapevine, that is entangled or growing on top of this peach tree. V'nekar farseik. And then the peach tree was uprooted or removed. So now the vine, this grapevine, has nothing to run along. I mean, you're going to have to put up trellises, you're going to have to do something else. But when the individual bought it, he bought it because he thought it was going to be running on the peach tree. As long as this grapevine stays alive, you have to provide a peach tree for it to rest on, because that's what you sold him. You sold him a vine on a peach tree. So if the peach tree doesn't exist anymore, you got to replace it. I mean, I don't know if he literally has to put on a put up a peach tree. I think he has to put up what the equivalent of a peach tree would be, which would be something sufficient to support the vine over here. All right, we'll stop over here, because the next sugya continues all the way down to the two dots, and the next stop, and we'll continue with that to tomorrow.